the headlines, millions of Iranians are heading to the polls to elect members of the country's parliament and the assembly of experts. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution calls on voters to cast their ballots in the early hours of the voting, saying that a high turnout will disappoint the ill-wishers of the nation. And the UN Rights Chief warns Israel's ground invasion of the southern Gaza city of Rafah would incur potentially massive loss of life on people that are sheltering there. Hello and welcome, everybody. It's election day in Iran, and people are heading to the polls to cast their ballots. Well, in Iran, people are heading to the polls to cast their ballots for parliament and assembly of experts. Voters are taking part in the parliamentary election to choose 290 members of the legislative body from over 15,000 candidates. Elected members will serve for a term of 4 years in the parliament. In another election, which is being held simultaneously, participants are voting for 88 members of the assembly of experts, a deliberative body elected for 8 years. This is the 12th parliamentary election and the sixth voting for the Assembly of Experts since the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution. More than 61 million people are eligible to vote for both elections. Iranian voters have expressed their unwavering support for the Islamic Revolution by actively participating in the ongoing elections. Iranians say they deeply believe in their power of their collective voice and the democratic process in the Islamic Republic. Let's take a listen to what they have to say.
With our votes, we want to show that despite problems and deficiencies in the country's governance, the people are wholeheartedly supporting the revolution, their national interests, and their country.
We have to fulfill our duty to the extent we can. Yes, there are many problems, too many problems. We're sad and we voice our criticism as much as we can. God willing, those responsible will think about them, and probably many of them do care.
I feel that the participation is much better than last time, and in my opinion, people are optimistic about the elections.
With all the propaganda that hostile media made, I think the turnout would be higher than the previous round.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has cast his ballot in the country's parliamentary and assembly of experts elections. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei voted in the Tehran constituency as soon as polls opened across the nation on Friday. The Iranian Vice President for Parliamentary Affairs has, in an interview, elaborated on the importance of the parliament and elections within the constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Let's take a listen to what he told our correspondent earlier in Tehran.
In the Islamic Republic, there is no authority that can dissolve the parliament. In some countries, the president can dissolve the parliament and call for snap elections. But we have the 12th Majlis being formed and every 4 years, and there's been no parliament that has been incomplete. And all the parliaments have continued their work until the very end. And the resolutions of the parliament cannot be dismissed. But in the US, the president can veto the resolutions, or in Germany or France, but such a thing does not exist here. And so you cannot dissolve or veto the parliament in Iran. And the parliament can also ask questions of the president. And so we had this at the beginning of the revolution. And so remove the president. So not only can the president not remove and dissolve the parliament in Iran, but it's a president that can, it's the parliament that can remove the president in Iran.
Our correspondent, Gisumisha Ahmadi, at one of the polling stations, has talked to Iran's vice president and head of planning and budget organization, Dr. Davood Manzoor, said the high number of candidates vying for each legislative seat shows how fierce the competition is in this election.
Right now, I'm joined by head of the budget and planning organization, also vice president of Iran, Dr. Davood Manzoor. Thank you very much for joining us. Now, first of all, this time around, we have more than 15,000 candidates competing for 290 seats. What does that mean?
This number of candidates, this shows that actually they have an opportunity to have a neck-and-neck competition. Candidates who have been qualified, they come from a whole range of political parties and different political parties. Naturally, the high number of candidates, there are more than 50 candidates for each seat up for grabs. This shows that we, in the true sense of the word, we do believe in the competition in the elections.
We also have a large number of women candidates, which is also unprecedented.
In each term, we are seeing the presence of women, both as candidates and as actually elected representatives. Their number is increasing.
The UN Human Rights Chief has once again issued a stark warning against Israel's planned ground offensive on the southern Gaza Strip city of Rafah.
A ground assault would incur potentially massive loss of life, additional risk of atrocity crimes, new displacement to another unsafe location distribution, and sign a death warrant for any hope of effective humanitarian aid. For my part, I fail to see how such an operation could be consistent with the binding provisional measures that were issued by the International Court of Justice.
Turk told the UN Human Rights Council that an attack on Rafah would take the nightmare that is being inflicted on Gazans to a new dimension. He slammed the regime's attacks and killings in Gaza as examples of Israel's brutality and carnage. Turk stressed that there are no words to capture the horrors that are unfolding in Gaza. Rafah is the territory's most populated area, where over 1.5 million people are sheltering. They have nowhere safe to go, and many of them have already been displaced multiple times. Condemnations are pouring in from all over the world against the latest Israeli massacre of innocent Palestinians scrambling for life-saving aid in the north of Gaza.
For heaven's sake, put an end to killing civilians, children, women. According to the information that we have, dozens of them have bullets in their heads. It was intentionally targeting and killing, and the number that we have now is 112 have been killed, and the number is increasing, and 750 injured, and possibly the number would be increasing. This outrageous, massacre is a testimony to the fact that as long as the Security Council is paralyzed and vetoes casted, then it is costing the Palestinian people their lives.
The Secretary General condemns the incident today in northern Gaza, in which more than 100 people were reportedly killed or injured while seeking life-saving aid.
We have always condemned the attack.
France has also reacted to the heinous massacre, with the country's ambassador to the UN saying civilians and civilian infrastructure should never be targeted. China has also strongly condemned the Gaza aid delivery deaths. Meanwhile, the Iranian Foreign Ministry in a statement said the wounds of Gaza will not be erased from the memory of the world's free people. Turkey, Egypt, and Jordan are among the regional countries that have condemned the cold-blooded murder. The UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs warned that life is draining out of Gaza. Israeli soldiers on Thursday opened fire and killed hundreds of starving Palestinians who were trying to get life-saving aid. Well, a draft proposal has been released as a result of extensive talks in Paris over a potential ceasefire in Gaza. One of the conditions exclusively prevents displaced men of military service age from returning to their homes in northern Gaza. Our correspondent Moti Abu Musabe has talked to some of the Palestinians in Deir al-Balah about the ceasefire's conditions.
This proposal is null and meaningless to me. I'm married and have kids. I can't let them go back to Gaza while I'm still here. We prefer to die here rather than accepting this proposal. We demand a permanent ceasefire that guarantees our full return to our residential areas in Gaza. Undoubtedly, it's another pressure exerted on the Palestinian resistance.
This is another pressure practiced against us. They know that the displaced families are not going to accept it. No one accepts to abandon the rest of his family and go back without them. They propose it just to blackmail us. I won't accept going back to Gaza without my husband. And my mother won't accept that return without my brothers. We fled our homes in Gaza together, and we will return together.
It's impossible to accept such a thing. Our men raise our kids day by day until they grow up. We spent these horrific days worrying about our children and young men. We escaped the killing in Gaza to protect them. We can't leave them and get back. We live together or we die together. No one would accept it. It's unnegotiable. We are still steadfast until we go back in dignity.
It's definitely rejected. We have been displaced from Gaza for the sake of our children's safety. They killed thousands of our children and our men, and they destroyed our homes and buildings. But now they propose us to go back without our sons and men. No rational human being would agree on this. This proposal means that Israel is procrastinating and it dogs having a real deal. Netanyahu is a war criminal and he wants to prolong this war against us.
Firstly, this proposal is completely rejected. It's a continuation of the expulsion that took place at the beginning of this war in Gaza. They want to separate the families and increase their suffering. They want the women and children to go to Gaza while keeping the men here so they can target them at any moment under any pretext. This is another way that Israeli occupation procrastinates putting the ceasefire deal in place in order to continue its genocide in Gaza.
Well, people have once again taken to the streets in the Yemeni city of Sa'ada in a show of support for Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The Yemeni protesters waved Palestinian flags and chanted slogans against Israel and its main supporter, the U.S. The protesters have been holding rallies on Friday since the Gaza war broke out in early October. They held pictures of their leaders in a show of support for their pro-Palestine operations. Those operations have targeted Israeli-linked vessels in the Red Sea in an effort to pressure the regime to stop its genocide in Gaza. The Yemeni protesters have also voiced support for their army's operations against U.S. and U.K. ships in response to their ongoing strikes on Yemen. The airstrikes began in the wake of Yemeni attacks in the Red Sea. Now to the U.K., where veteran pro-Palestinian politician George Galloway has won a vote to become a new lawmaker following an election campaign dominated by Israeli lobby groups.
Well, you know, a genocide is not a small thing, and the International Court of Justice has already sent Israel for trial, having concluded that there was a plausible case for genocide being committed in the Gaza Strip. That's not a small thing. That doesn't happen every day. But the local politicians here in the council and the national politicians across the consensus of the front benches want to pretend that it isn't happening, want to disguise that they are deeply involved in it. They're giving cover to it and even given military collaboration with it.
Galloway, who is a left-wing politician, became the new lawmaker for the northern town of Rochdale after running a pro-Palestinian campaign. He won people's votes through criticizing the Labour Party and governing politicians for supporting the Israeli regime. The Labour Party, which withdrew its support for its own candidate over anti-Israeli comments, was beaten into fourth place. Galloway's victory comes as the growing support for Palestine has brought people in the UK to streets to condemn Israeli crimes against the people of Gaza. Hundreds of thousands have rallied to condemn Israel since the beginning of its genocidal war on Gaza on October the 7th. That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
On the occasion of the 40th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, February 11th, 2019, justice and fight against corruption, these two virtues necessitate each other. Economic, moral, and political corruption are like tumors in the body of countries and governments. If found in the body of a system of governance, they would constitute a devastating quake and a heavy blow to their legitimacy. And for an establishment like the Islamic Republic that requires beyond the common legitimacy and social acceptance, this is far more serious and fundamental than for any other systems. The temptations of wealth, power, and rank weaken some, even in the most resembling of all governments to Imam Ali's governance, that is, Amir al-Mu'mineen's own government. Thus, the hazard posed by the emergence of such a threat in the Islamic Republic, whose officials once competed each other in revolutionary piety and maintaining a simple lifestyle, has never been and still is not far from probable. This makes the constant presence of an efficient organization with sharp eyes and decisive actions within the three branches of powers, executive, legislature, judiciary, necessary, in order to truly fight corruption, especially in governmental bodies.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Of course, the proportion of corrupt individuals among the officials of the Islamic Republic is much smaller than that of many other countries, and particularly to that of the Pahlavi regime, which was totally corrupt and encouraged corruption. And thanks be to God, the agents of this system have mostly stayed clean from it. However, even the slightest corruption is unacceptable. Everyone must know that economic transparency is the precondition for the legitimacy for all officials of the Islamic Republic. Everybody must beware of the evil of greed and avoid illegitimate earnings and supplicate to God to help them in this regard. Supervising and governmental organizations must prevent corruption from being conceived and fight its spread with sincerity and sensitivity.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. You've done for me through all my years.
everyone. Welcome to our program. I'm your host, Ali Reza Ikhtiarzadeh. Today, we go face-to-face with the head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization, Mr. Mohammad Islami, as we talk about the different fields where Iran has made significant advancements in when it comes to nuclear science and technology, and also talk about some of the double standards that the UN nuclear watchdog has been using when it comes to its attitude towards the Islamic Republic of Iran, and see where it originates from. So stay tuned. Mr. Mohammad Islami, thank you for joining the program.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be with you.
We are as well. So let's first talk about the document for the 20-year nuclear technology vision that we have. Can you tell me about what goals are set in that document?
Indeed, in the name of Allah, the Most Gracious, the Most Merciful. Every organization naturally needs a vision, a defined plan within a specific time frame, outlining goals, policies, and strategies based on studies of actual conditions, aligning the organization's movement with those very directions. By divine grace, we managed to formulate the document for the 20-year vision of nuclear technology, with the participation of all relevant parties, leading to the recognition of the industry's potential impact on all dimensions of people's lives and the modern economy. This was well received by all relevant bodies within the Islamic Republic of Iran's administration and establishment, and we were able to have the document unveiled by the president after going through all the stages of approval. In the middle of the last Persian calendar year, when this document was unveiled, the entire organization's movement was aligned with the path laid by the document. We are currently progressing along this path with five primary goals in mind. Firstly, the process of nuclear fuel supply and necessary activities within the industrial chain and testing in the fuel process. Our aim is to complete and reach the capacity necessary to cover the required objectives outlined in the document. This was an effective step, indicating our utilization of diverse resources, allowing our fuel cycle to become a comprehensive, sustainable industry capable of expansion. We are progressing in this direction. The second pillar was clean and sustainable energy. Climate change is a serious global concern, with a net zero carbon emission target set for 2050. Naturally, our country, being highly vulnerable to climate change, has strongly emphasized the goal of producing clean and sustainable energy. We have included the objective of generating 20,000 megawatts of new nuclear power in this vision document, requiring comprehensive scientific and industrial research efforts to achieve this goal. The third pillar observed in this process was the development of the nuclear industry in the medical and health sector. In the medical and health domain, we target expanding the capacity for producing radiopharmaceuticals in order to become a global player and a consistent innovator at the forefront. We aim to benefit from the nuclear industry in producing radioisotopes, radiopharmaceuticals, especially novel radioisotopes, and radiopharmaceuticals, and this too is a focal point of the industry. The fourth focus is the development of irradiation applications and protection against contamination. In a real sense, two extensive steps are dedicated to ensuring food security and community health. We utilize irradiation to sterilize agricultural products. In our country, which annually produces around 130 million tons of agricultural goods, this process helps eliminate toxins and pests and extends their shelf life. This, in turn, contributes to national economic prosperity, supports businesses in this domain, and boosts household economies. Additionally, protection against radiation contamination is crucial. Accordingly, the Safety Protection Center is slated to evolve into a more efficient state institution, capable of appropriately fulfilling its legal duty of radiation protection. The fifth pillar of the vision document concerns human resources. We require effective human resources. Our approach to industrial research and development involves considering the development of human resources and scientific advancement. This pillar includes R&D projects at the forefront of knowledge aimed at practical flourishing, technological attainment, streamlining the innovation cycle from idea to product, and simultaneously ensuring the necessary workforce for the present and future of the organization. These were the five fundamental chapters observed in the vision document.
Right, so let's go over each of these points one by one. So the first one was the procurement of the nuclear fuel for the reactors. So let's talk about the process of getting there. So from the excavation of uranium-235 to the utilization of uranium-235. How much of this process is domesticized, and where are we in reaching that goal we have in the 20-year vision?
Clearly, we're one of the countries significantly affected by unjust double standards. Due to nuclear sanctions, there has been no cooperation provided to us in our nuclear sector. Hence, all our processes in research are directed toward anticipated results, utilizing our research capabilities specifically tailored to yield technological products, especially nuclear fuel. Today, we possess a sustainable capacity for our required fuel, aiming to independently design, construct, and operate power plants, needing critical fuel and ultimately operating them with Iranian-made fuel.
So let's go over the second point that you mentioned with regards to the goals of the IAEA. According to the recent remarks by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, he said that reaching that 20,000 megawatts of power generated through these nuclear power plants is crucial for the 20-year vision. Where are we along the path of reaching that 20,000 megawatts?
We've designed an operation plan for this 20,000 megawatts. Based on studies conducted in Iran by Westerners over the past 50 years for establishing nuclear power plants, which we updated, we identified regions and established companies for achieving the 20,000 megawatt target by setting up and operating nuclear power generation plants. These companies primarily function along the southern coasts, with one also situated in the northern coastal area, conducting in-depth environmental and geological studies. One of these companies, ahead in its environmental geological data, has progressed to the stage of ordering equipment and initiating operational activities at its site. Therefore, every 20,000 megawatt capacity has been divided into five different regions, each of them in a different phase of operation within the program, and each is in motion.
The third point was the usage of nuclear science and technology in the medical field. So there are, of course, different areas where you can tackle medical sciences using nuclear sciences. For example, let's talk about using plasma therapy and where we are in the world when it comes to our position, when it comes to plasma therapy, and what kind of cancers or different types of illnesses are we targeting with it.
Currently, in the field of radioisotopes and radiopharmaceuticals, we have reached operational capacity with about 50 radiopharmaceuticals used in diagnostic, palliative, and therapeutic areas. Approximately 1 million individuals in the country benefit from these medical services and radiopharmaceuticals annually. Importantly, we're expanding our capacity in this realm, both qualitatively and quantitatively. Qualitatively, we aim for higher precision in diagnostic radioisotopes to aid medical professionals in better diagnosis. And quantitatively, we're striving to enhance their effectiveness, especially for therapeutic radiopharmaceuticals. Currently, we have 13 new radiopharmaceuticals undergoing critical trials, progressing along this path. Parallel to the discussion on radiopharmaceuticals is plasma therapy. We've dedicated efforts to plasma therapy over the past 2 years. Currently, the clinical trial phase involves using plasma for treating non-healing wounds, particularly in diabetic patients. Another clinical phase is plasma therapy for cancer treatment, currently being used in operating rooms. We're expanding plasma therapy utilization for its significant potential in combating cancer. and we're actively pursuing this goal.
Now, before I touch on the fourth point, one of the goals of the IAEA has been to implement the usage of smaller scale reactors. I want to know about the reason behind that and how far along we are in implementing and reaching that goal that we want to.
Look, the objective outlined by the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, and the global pursuit, particularly in the recent COP28 summit in Abu Dhabi, where countries pledged to triple their nuclear power capacities, aims at carbon emission reduction. Carbon emission reduction is attainable through increased nuclear power plant capacity. However, not all countries or locations can accommodate large-scale nuclear plants. Hence, research into miniature technology has been underway. This aims to design and build small-scale, widely distributed nuclear power plants in various countries, facilitating the pursuit of the 2050 net-zero carbon emission goal. Because nuclear power plants' efficiency is often over 93% to 95%, unlike other power plants with significantly lower efficiency, the stability and cleanliness of this energy emphasizes accelerating this IAEA-defined goal through scientific and engineering endeavors.
Now, the fourth goal that you mentioned for the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran was the usage of irradiation and the tools that we use to protect the operators from irradiation when they're working in, like, for example, reactors and the radioisotope making. So can you tell us about some of the different tools that we have been able to make? For example, there are the measurement tools, the precision tools that we have made, and also the contamination monitors, and also some of the usages of the irradiation, different irradiation devices that we have made.
There were two important aspects in your question that I want to address. Firstly, in the field of radioisotopes, one rapidly expanding aspect globally is the nuclear measurement system, nuclear instrumentation used in advanced industries. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran has introduced these systems, and today we have complete mastery of advanced versions of these nuclear instrumentation systems and design, and we produce and provide support for them for various industries in the country. This is one aspect. The second aspect regarding irradiation exposure involves our radiation-generating systems. We have designed cyclotrons and gamma irradiation systems, both pool-type and self-shielded types. We have incorporated these into our agenda to design these systems, procure the required irradiation sources, and through studies conducted for the country's needs, implement these across all production centers, be it industrial or agricultural products, suitable for irradiation. Over a three-year plan, God willing, we'll establish these to enable products to undergo radiation exposure, creating high added value financially and economically. Most importantly, this contributes to food security and public health. Irradiation not only increases productivity and efficiency, but also enhances safety and health for the people. Another critical point is our capability to provide various educational accelerators and research tools, similar to those in nuclear power plants. You'll find similar simulations, just like the one behind us, in the control rooms of Bushehr Nuclear Power Plant. These simulations serve educational purposes in universities and even in power plants for operational training. These systems, in line with research and human resource development in the fifth pillar that I mentioned, are designed, built, and made available to target centers.
Now, in the process of making all these radioisotopes or these precision tools, the density measurement tools and whatnot, and making of these radiopharmaceuticals, one crucial point, especially when it comes to the reactors and where the radioisotopes are made, is the usage of heavy water and light water. So we consume and produce a lot of both of these two types of waters, and I would assume there's a level of exporting that we do for these light and heavy waters. So what is our place globally when it comes to the exports and the demand that there is for our light and heavy water?
This is a very important issue. Our organization is a key player globally as a producer of heavy water, holding a sustainable share in the international market. Our capacity stands out significantly compared to our competitors due to its quality. What's important for us is not just the heavy water used in reactors, but also its derivatives, approximately 230 types, which find utility across various industries, particularly in pharmaceuticals, especially medications based on deuterium. We're following this path and are thankful that through the efforts of our young scientists and researchers, we have achieved this global standard. We're currently expanding and enhancing the capabilities and the efficiency of these products.
So we're right now at the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, and perhaps the most important parts of this whole facility, this whole area, is the Nuclear Science and Technology Research Center. What is the goal, the main goal, of this Nuclear Science and Technology Research Center?
Relentless movement towards progress serves as the goal of our research sector. This allows us to stay on the path at the forefront of knowledge, utilize our findings through articles and commercialization of technologies to serve humanity, and expand them. Our distinction from advanced countries when it comes to new sciences and technologies lies in our dedication to serving humanity and sustainability of peace. We don't impose control, but engage with all countries with the aim of making these technologies available to them. Therefore, our research direction aims to remain at the forefront of knowledge and relentlessly pursue new findings.
So a major part of the research side of things happens right here. But how does this research and the results that come out of it get implemented into industries? What does the path look like, and where do knowledge-based companies play a part along this path?
The knowledge-based companies born out of this research stream are technological developers. We undertake the risks associated with these new technologies initially to the extent where risks are minimized, enabling other companies and industries to utilize them. The research flow and the technology development stream in the Atomic Energy Organization is being handled within a knowledge-based network. We have introduced open project policies and innovation, intending to utilize all capacities in the process of transforming knowledge into technology and industry. Our perspective is international, and that's why next year, on the 50th anniversary of the Atomic Energy Organization's establishment, we're organizing the first international nuclear conference in Iran, welcoming various countries and the agency. Our inaugural conference carries the message of peaceful nuclear technology for everyone and nuclear weapons for no one. In this regard, we're pleased that through an international initiative next year, we'll be the initiators of an active movement to promote nuclear sciences and technologies globally.
Now let's get a more in-depth look at one of these nuclear power plants and see what it is actually capable of. So, for instance, the Bushehr nuclear power plant. What is the capacity of its power production, and what can we expect from it in the future?
Power plant number one in Bushehr is a facility with a nominal capacity of 1,025 megawatts. This power plant, in the year of 2023, has completed its 10th year of operation. To date, it has injected over 62 billion kilowatt hours of electricity into our national grid, preventing the emission of over 90 million cubic meters of greenhouse gases and saving approximately 90 million barrels of oil. This demonstrates Iran's commitment to clean energy. We're addressing a lag in the construction of power plants by expediting the implementation of units 2 and 3 in the Bushehr power plant, currently under construction. Our endeavor in executing the 20,000 megawatt plan is to showcase ourselves as prominent players in the global field of atomic power plant design and construction. It's a response to the political turmoil and psychological security measures that have been fabricated against Iran's nuclear program, which are entirely false and baseless. We operate transparently and under the supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, extending our nuclear activities for peace and security.
So the Bushehr facility is a nuclear power plant. Over here, in this facility, we have a research reactor. What are the other research reactors or power plants that we can expect in the future to be made?
We currently have two research reactors that are being designed and constructed. One is a 20-megawatt research reactor, and the other is a 10-megawatt research reactor. Additionally, we have a zero-power research reactor intended for educational and research purposes in the design and construction phase. These three projects constitute our research backbone, supporting our national education and the production of various radioisotopes required in the medical and industrial sectors.
So the next subject would be nuclear fusion technology. It's, to my understanding, the next step for us. So where are we along the path of reaching the technology to be able to use nuclear fusion and the power that we get from that?
This is a very important point. Nuclear fusion is the future, particularly when it comes to achieving clean, sustainable energy, and it is being pursued collectively and individually by nations. In our country, within the Atomic Energy Organization, one of our key and fundamental projects is the nuclear fusion project. Utilizing all scientific and research elements that can assist the organization and participate in the projects, we have initiated these plans with the goal of creating a tokamak with a designated scale. Hopefully, we can present our research findings.
So why even is it the future step? Why is nuclear fusion technology more difficult to achieve? And how do you compare the power or the usage that we get out of nuclear fusion compared to the nuclear fission reactors that we already have?
It's evident that this path is both challenging and costly, involving time-consuming and expansive research efforts. All nations involving in this matter are working towards maintaining sustainable energy. No one casts an economic view on this matter. Everyone is working on it with a scientific and research-oriented approach. What matters is the existence of this activity, regardless of the scale or duration of the energy derived from nuclear fusion. The importance lies in mastering the processes, elements, and components to transform it into a system, be it projects carried out worldwide or aligned with the focus observed in France. We are continuing our efforts independently, aligning with those pursuits.
So let's stay on the topic of these international governing bodies, namely the IAEA. So the International Atomic Energy Agency has said in a recent report that Iran has increased its production of highly enriched uranium, to which you responded that there has been no change in our capacity for production. Do you think that the IAEA may be playing into the hands of the Zionist entity and their propaganda machine?
This is quite clear. Even in the instance where the Director General speaks and warns the world, saying, don't forget about Iran while your attention is on Gaza, it fuels Iranophobia, contrary to international norms and against the rights of a nation. We haven't engaged in any undisclosed activities for him to caution us like this or to remind us that we need JCPOA 2.0. These actions are adherence to requests that are made of them. We have always requested the Director General to uphold the agency's credibility as an international independent body, unaffected by political agenda. And we stated in a March 2023 statement addressing the agency that the framework of our activities are based on the IAEA safeguards and the NPT. Considering the remaining items, we will interact and define a modality for the remaining issues and in-between matters between the two parties. These three clauses exist. There is currently no discrepancy or non-compliance between us, even regarding inspectors. The issue with the inspectors is an inherent right of any country and nation. According to Article 9, the agency must introduce inspectors to us. We evaluate the inspectors and express our opinion. This routinely happens. If we cancel a designee inspector, or several inspectors, it's within the realm of inspections, and those inspectors hadn't even come to Iran in the first place. Then they portray it as if their inspectors were expelled. We didn't expel any inspectors. There haven't been any inspectors in Iran whom we expelled. There is a list, a roster, currently 125 inspectors, if I'm not mistaken, who are designees, meaning Iran has agreed for them to visit. However, not all of them necessarily come to Iran. So the excessive focus on Iran, the timely and untimely reports about Iran, is entirely contrary to norms. It's a double standard, and we strongly oppose this double standard. We have expressed our grievances to the agency and always expect the Director General to maintain that international credibility of the agency and not join the pressure group, the group consisting of three European countries that exert pressure on Iran, never align with them, and allow our relations to proceed naturally within the framework of the agreements and the MPT.
Mr. Islami, thank you very much for joining the program and for your time. Well, you heard about how the International Atomic Energy Agency has been adopting double standards with its approach to Iran and where it may be originating from. It's unfortunate, but that's the way it is. But that's not going to stop Iran's advancements in different fields of nuclear science and technology. That's going to be it for this edition of Face to Face.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. The Last Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
Light of Allah.
Redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. Welcome back to a new episode of The Last Savior. I am Bita, the host of today's episode. And once again, we have the opportunity to be here to answer your questions, doubts, and misconceptions about Mahdaviya. And here with me in studio is Brother Alavian. Welcome, brother, to our studio. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you very much for inviting me to your show. It's a great pleasure for me to be here.
We are once here again in order to answer the doubts, questions, or misconception about Mahdaviya. And in this episode specifically, we're going to talk about the women and at the time of occultation. Most of the time when we listen to the stories and narrations of the scholars of the time about their connection to Imam Mahdi, we see that these scholars, most of them, all of them for sure, are men. But is there any woman in the time of occultation of Imam Mahdi that had the felicity to be at service of this Imam or not?
We might not heard that, okay, there hadn't been any lady who reached to this level of felicity and prosperity that she had the honor of serving Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, or visiting Imam alayhi salam in the time of occultation. But whatever we have not heard does not mean that it does not exist.
Yeah,
so
for sure.
It might exist and it might happen, as we have heard, and we have even some of them have been documented and even have been written in the format of books. And there are lots of ladies who had this chance to visit Imam alayhi salam and had talks with Imam, and it happened. But on the other hand, we have in a hadith that at the time of his arrival and at the time of Imam's advent, almost 50 of the Imam's companions, specific companions of Imam, are from ladies and sisters. It's really a remarkable number. So, but what do we mean by contacting or having relation with Imam? What is it that we are always in thirst of it to know and to learn? That what is the value of such a contact and, let's say, relation with Imam? What are we talking about, actually? Usually, the relation happens between two people that know each other well. When we have no familiarity and acquaintance with anyone, how can we expect a relation to happen, right? So this relation requires a sort of familiarity from one side and the other side knows a bit. I mean, at least from one side. I mean, one of these sides at least should be known to the other, right?
Yeah, all right.
So, and there must be a sort of love or attraction between these people. We know from the language of traditions and the wordings of narrations that imams are always in thirst of having a contact with their companions and with their followers. And we shall recite also some of these ahadith that tells us. But it's not a one-sided issue. It's a two-sided issue. I mean, if you are going to talk about the relationship between imam and his followers, whether they are ladies or men, we don't differentiate between these two because we believe that the concept of women, as we talked about it earlier, was revolutionized in Islam. The kind of respect that Islam gave to Lady Fatima salamu alayha. Till today, everything had changed. And Islam is very high in giving respect to the ladies, as we said earlier. I mean, you can see no other school of thought that gives that much importance to a lady like Islam.
Yeah.
Because, you see, the imam of the time, he says that my role model is my mother Fatima salamu alayha. So how come? They are the source of blessings. Ladies in Islam are the sources of blessings. So what kind of relations are we expecting to have? Two kinds of relations. A heart relation and a relation, or let's say a contact in person.
So brother, let's have the elaboration of these two different categories after a short break.
Inshallah.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old
Welcome back, dear listeners. We were talking about the relation that we mean whenever we point and focus on the Imam Mahdi, whether it be women or men, that my brother mentioned that in our religion, Islam, which was a revolution itself about the value of men and women, that there is no difference between these two other than their piety or virtue. So, brother, we're all here about the two categories that you were mentioning.
So we said that this relation with imam that we're talking about can happen in either one of these two forms. One, a heart relation, a contact, or a relation or contact in person. That is to meet Imam Ali and to visit Imam Ali. So we earlier said that this relation usually happens when there is sort of familiarity between either sides of these two relation. I mean, one of them should know at least each other well to do something for this relation to happen.
Yeah.
And we have it from the side of imam. We have lots of hadith, narrations that tells us that imams or prophet or imams, the prophet was tabibun dawwarun bitibbih. That is, he was looking for the sick people to come. He was like a doctor who was searching for the disease, for the illness, for the ills.
Yeah, exactly.
And the sick people to come and for him to remedy and cure them, right? Let me tell you again from Imam Zaman himself. He says, "You are not indifferent towards your issues and affairs. And we are not forgetting your issues and affairs, and we do not forget your remembrance." Look, the love started from the other side. He says that we are not forgetting your remembrance. So
yeah,
he
definitely
starts this love. I mean, we are a little bit back in this relation. I mean, we are too distant from this relation to start it while we are, okay, where is, had any lady yet seen imam or not? Or what are we talking about? When he's the starter of this relation. So he's the one that is searching for us. I mean, this is the status of this love that we are talking about. So when a love happens, a relation starts, and it's interesting that the relation starts from the other side. So what is from our side? Whom do we know that tells us such a thing, except our parents, for example?
Yeah.
Right? This is, I'm always caring for you. I'm always praying for you. I'm always waiting for you to come. Even our parents do not tell us that much, I mean, that much cozy, right? I want to say that even as soon as the children are growing older, they usually say less of such statements and words. But we see that Imam says, no, I'm not indifferent towards the issue. I'm always caring for you, right? He's kinder than the parents, kinder than the mother and father. We have not yet understood who this person that we are going to have contact with is, what characteristic he has, and what spiritual beauties this person have that is in search of us. Are we expecting such a thing happen overnight? For example, I have tried a light, but I couldn't meet Imam Ali Salam. No, Imam does not exist because I didn't meet him. So whatever you did not see or whatever you did not visit does not exist?
No,
I'm asking you.
It's not like that.
I'm asking you, do you see the pain?
No.
Do you see the prosperity? Do you see happiness of a person while he's not laughing? Whatever cannot be seen does not necessarily mean that it does not exist. So Imam does exist, and he has relation with some. And if we try our best, this relation can happen. But how?
Thank you, Brother Ali, for your elaboration, for beautiful examples about the love of Imam for us. And the interesting fact that this love and this relation starts from Imam himself towards us. And the next level of actually analyzing this topic is about how can we be at the position and status of be the actually mutual partner and the other side of this relationship, which it's going to be discussed after a short break.
أهدى سنه مهديون في الأزمان شع ضيه ربنا في العالمين أطفع له نور أليق والظالم ابتده من أجل السالكين.
So welcome back, dear listeners. This is the program, The Last Savior. And in this part, we're going to talk more about the characteristic of a true follower of Imam as a party of this unconditional love that Imam will give us.
Well, we need to start this relation with deep heart relation, with a deep heart contact. I mean, it can start from, again, from whatever they have taught us. I mean, in the language of narrations, we see lots of supplications that they are very beautiful. They tell us, okay, peace on you at the time that you stand, at the time that you sit. Look, this is sort of loving sentences that we tell to the beloved.
Yeah.
You see, when such relation had started, then slowly we see that okay, something comes up. I mean, but this contact, if a person has the tawfiq, the blessing to had the honor of meeting Imam alayhi salam, will have either a visit of Imam in person or a heart contact. So what do we mean by these two? When a person has the tawfiq to meet Imam alayhi salam in person, it is either of these two ways. While he meets Imam, but he doesn't know that he is the Imam himself. So he has a good talk, or he or she can have a pretty good talk with Imam alayhi salam and everything. And when after finishing this talk, he or she understands that, it was Imam alayhi salam. You see? And this kind of relation has been narrated and has been mentioned and has been documented by some. And sometimes when a person is that strong enough, like the ones that who have worked on themselves a lot and they have observed taqwa in the best way possible. So they meet Imam and they know that he is the Imam. They know that the person that they are meeting is Imam alayhi salam. This is a higher